From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Mamie Till Mobley was worried when her 14-year-old son left Chicago to stay with a relative in Tallahatchie County, Mississippi. It was the summer of 1955, a year after the Supreme Court decision to desegregate schools had passed. But still, Mamie grew up in the Deep South and knew things were different. That August, 14-year-old Emmett Till was kidnapped, tortured, and killed for allegedly whistling at a white woman. The two men charged with the murder were acquitted. That was 63 years ago. Last week, the Justice Department announced it will reopen the case. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Hank Klibanoff is a professor at Emory University. There, he oversees a project to investigate civil rights cold cases, one of which he's covered as hosts of the Buried Truths podcast. Hank, so great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Now, this new development has come out more than 60 years after the murder. What are your thoughts? Why did it take so long?
Well, for one thing, we've been here before because there was a reopening at the state level by a district attorney over in the Mississippi Delta, and she looked at it for quite a while. Is it important to point out she's African-American? I think it might be as relevant. And she couldn't find enough to proceed with this.
So no revelations, no indictments.
No indictments. But at that point, you didn't have what you now have, which is Carolyn Bryant, the wife at the time of 1955 of Roy Bryant, who was part of one of the two people who openly admitted he abducted Till and openly admitted that he beat up Till, but then says he didn't kill him, that they left Till on the side of the road. She has now said that what she told him, which is that Emmett Till came on to her, whistled at her, all these things, was not true.
So what happens to her in an investigation like this?
Well, you know, my guess is they're in the federal courts, they're going to have a hard time. This is announced by the, you know, Justice Department. That's the federal judiciary, federal court. They would even have a hard time convicting her of murder. There's not really much of a murder charge you can bring in federal court unless it happens on federal property or an Indian reservation or involves crossing county lines, state lines, I mean. So she would be most likely prosecuted successfully in the state courts. That's where murder is prosecuted. But the further complication is that what would you charge her with? Either accomplice to the murder or perjury, both of which have statutes of limitations. And I don't know how they get around that, particularly when they're descending from the federal level into the state of Mississippi to try to get a prosecution.
I was wondering about the legality of that. This was in the Bush era. There was the Department of Justice and FBI began investigating unsolved racially motivated cases. Here is then FBI Director Robert Mueller. This is in 2007.
Many murders during the civil rights era were not fully investigated, were covered up, or were misidentified as an accidental death or disappearance. Many trails ran cold, and many cases were effectively closed. But for the victims and their parents, children, siblings, friends, the wounds are never closed.
In 2016, President Obama signed the Emmett Till Civil Rights Crime Reauthorization Act, mm-hmm. So actually named for Till. So how was this different than the earlier authorization?
Well, not appreciably. When it first passed, the first Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crimes Act, when it first passed, it had very little effect. For those of us who are out in the field examining these cases, we rarely came across the tracks of the FBI. And when we did, they were usually going off to conferences on cyber crime, on white collar crime, on the prime rate mortgage meltdown, on human trafficking. The FBI set about trying to close as many of those cases as they could to determine that there's no living perpetrator, and let's close it and get it off the books. And the only cases to this day that the FBI and Department of Justice have prosecuted, successfully reinvestigated and prosecuted of this nature, these civil rights cold cases, are all because a journalist first revealed it and brought so much attention to it and really built the case and then handed it over to the FBI and the Department of Justice.
Hank Klibanoff is with us. He's former managing editor of the AJC, author of The Race Beat. He oversees the Cold Case Project at Emory University. And we're talking about the reopening of one of the country's most infamous cold cases, that is the murder of Emmett Till 63 years ago. Well, this is what you're doing at Emory. You are teaching students. You're one of the groups working on these kind of cases with students. Mm-hmm. Are they actually working to solve these crimes?
Well, we get them very granular and in detail, but our goal is not, we're not pursuing the whodunit because we know who did it. The records are very clear who did it. If they were still alive, we would love to be able to point out, here's who did it, they're still alive, they were never successfully prosecuted, or somehow justice was thwarted. In almost every case, they're dead. The perpetrators are dead. And in the few cases where maybe they might be alive, reconstructing that, the trail of evidence would be very difficult. My goal is not necessarily to reopen the cases because it's almost impossible at this stage, but to teach the history, to teach who we were as a people back then, to try to understand who we were as a people, and to try to see how much today we resemble who we were back then.
That's opening up something big. I'm thinking about when the new lynching memorial, the National Lynching Memorial, was built or opened in Montgomery to much great fanfare. There was also, the governor did not attend, of Alabama. Some Montgomery residents complained this focuses on the cruelty, you know, opening old wounds, let sleeping dogs lie. Have you heard similar resistance to the work that you're doing?
You hear that. You hear that, absolutely. Even the other day when there was, legislation introduced that's related to this, I saw people commenting on the website of the senator who introduced it, saying that was a long time ago. Can't we let bygones be bygones? Why can't black people get past this? And I just want to say, one, there is a reason why in this country we have no statute of limitations on murder. It's the one thing we're agreed on. Now, to my point earlier, in many cases, murder is not an option as a charge, murder charge, because the perpetrators are dead. But that whole ethos continues and remains, and that's the reason I teach it, is because even though we can no longer prosecute these people, we ought not ever forget it. And if we're going to remember it, we ought to remember it with the facts and with the true stories that are there.
Well, Emmett Till's death was covered famously by Jet magazine. As you said, the killers admitted to kidnapping and torturing him, really, for Look magazine. But you covered how the Race Beat was covered in the South. How was this story told in the South?
Very differently. The Mississippi Press was very tepid about covering it. I mean, the town of Sumner was pretty much overrun by reporters from AP and UPI and St. Louis and Chicago. All four major, main dailies in Chicago came down and covered it, as well as the Chicago Daily Defender, the black newspaper. You had reporters from all over the country coming in to cover this. And as far as Mississippi newspapers, neither of the two Jackson papers staffed it full time, the whole time, the two dominant newspapers. The largest of the two, I think, had a reporter up there, I can't recall, but something like one day, something like that. Mm-hmm. And their coverage was just designed to cast doubt on whether or not Till was still alive, whether, to cast doubt on the culpability of the two white men. I mean, there was generally an attitude, we kill black people down here all the time. I mean, why is this one different? Just because he was 14? And the answer is, one, yes, that's a good reason. And two, you had a judge and a prosecutor who were determined to do a pretty good job. And they weren't going to sort of play to the old South in certain ways, even though the defense attorneys were, and they were invoking all the to the jury, they would say, now your white forebears would be turning over in their grave if they thought that you might, bring a guilty verdict against these fine white men.
Emmett Till's death was also immortalized by Langston Hughes, Gwendolyn Brooks. William Faulkner wrote about it. Bob Dylan, of course, Toni Morrison, documentary filmmakers. Did your students, many of them probably 19, 20, 21, did they know the story of Emmett Till?
No, not really. It's a name they know. It's a name they know, but the details of which they don't know. And it's kind of interesting when I go around the room to the students and say, so how old are your grandparents? And, you know, they'll say, oh, 75, 70, 77, you know, something like that. And I'll say, that's how old Emmett Till would be right now, you know, or whatever year I'm in. That's the year that seems to match. And it's just sort of this pause there, this sort of subtle gasp in the room, like, oh, my God, you know, this was a living, breathing person who would today be with children and with grandchildren and be part of the, you know, the family fabric, who's not there now.
I've noticed in your Buried Truths podcast, it's telling the story of what happened, laying out the facts, but there's often not resolution, because I don't think there is resolution about what goes on in this country and its legacy of race. But there are little glimmers of hope. What has that experience been like for you, working with this Civil Rights Cold Cases Unit and telling those stories?
Well, I think it's, in an intellectual way, it shouldn't be a surprise. Emotionally, it might be, or it could be the other way. More emotionally, it's not a surprise, but intellectually it is, that people who were active in harassing, beating, and ultimately killing black people in those days just because they did it like drinking water, there's some number of them who have not moved past it and who are beleaguered by what they did and who are guilt-ridden. And, you know, they would do something awful on a Saturday night, whether it's plant a bomb or just, you know, use blacks for target practice while riding down some country road, who would then go in on Sunday morning into church and hear all the teachings and never really thought to square it up. And all these years later, some of them are squaring it up. And you've had some very dramatic examples of people coming clean on their past. So you may remember the instance of a man named Elwin Wilson from Rock Hill, South Carolina, who showed up at Congressman John Lewis's office once a few years ago and introduced himself and said, Congressman, you remember when you came through on the Freedom Ride buses to Rock Hill, South Carolina? And John Lewis says, oh, you bet I do. I got whacked over the head. And this Elwin Wilson says, that was me. I did it. And John Lewis, sort of taken aback, says, well, why are you here? He says, I'm here to apologize. Mm. And that's what he did. He had to get on the right side of history, had to get on the right side of God in his way of thinking. And he had done some other horrific things in his hometown, dangling little dolls of black kids, you know, from the tree, knowing that black children were going to have to walk by his house on their way to school. And I think what happens with some of these folks is that their time is coming, and they're now in their 80s, and they believe that they are probably destined for hell for what they did, and it scares them to death, and they want to come clean. And in some cases, they have done that quite dramatically. And as you know, without, you know, spoiling buried truths, there is a moment there, a very important moment when something very nice happens.
Hank Klibanoff, former managing editor at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Race Beat. And Hank is also host of the Buried Truths podcast. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Always good to be with you. Thank you, Virginia.